Dr. F.A.C. Oller's Rule 5.
Well, insofar as learning the Japanese language is concerned, it is very useful. First of all, it gave the Japanese the notion that you are willing to go along at least harmoniously with them, that you would be able to communicate with them better. And besides that, I mean, many of us found this a form of recreation, if you like to call it that, learning the language. I, for one, found it a very fascinating language to study. And I used to spend hours studying this language out of books, and I joined a course run by a Chinese girl at Dhobi Ghaut, her name, I can't remember again. And here we learned to converse in Japanese, we learned to write the simple katakana and the hiragana, to read the simple type of Japanese script, though not the kanji. And we were able to converse. And with a lot of with the increasing practice, we got quite proficient with the language.
Was this class a private one?
This is a private class, yes. And there were quite a number of these private classes at the time. And there were also quite a number of textbooks in Japanese which were published in Singapore and sold by local people.
This girl was a Chinese girl who
That's
could
right.
speak Japanese.
That's right.
Do you remember how many were in the class?
20, 30. But she used to have many classes. We didn't have to go every day, two or three times a week, but she used to have several sessions. She was very popular, this girl. Quite a young girl. And she was a good teacher.
Where were the classes held?
In Dhobi Ghaut, somewhere. One of those houses there.
Her house?
Yes, her own private house.
Usually how long were your lessons?
About an hour each time. And then we would be given, you know, homework, set work to do, and we used to do that. And we moved quite fast in studying the language. It is, I found the Japanese language a very fascinating language, and therefore it didn't take me, you know, too long to pick up the threads of it. Now if you ask me to speak Japanese because I have not been using or not practicing it, I just can't remember. The odd words I can. When I keep when I come across Japanese pages, I try to utter the odd word or two, you know, but I can't remember it. And yet I can't speak it nearly as well as I could during the Japanese occupation.
Do you remember when did you go for the class?
In the evenings.
When did you start taking up the lessons?
Well, I would say about 6 months after the Japanese occupation. But I had been doing my own studying before then. And I told you, by these Japanese soldiers we befriended, they started teaching me the language, the fundamentals. Of course, they didn't have books or anything of that sort, which didn't do to help me along, but just telling us the odd word or two. Their meanings.
Besides encouraging all of you to take up the learning of their language, how else did the Japanese go about in promoting their culture?
Well, they did introduce their songs, and I must say their songs were beautiful, but this is sort of bait. They did, however, force us to congregate at times, at the Esplanade, for example. Is it Yamashita who came to Singapore once? We all had to go to the Esplanade, and I think the communities were directed to congregate there members to go to and congregate there and form groups. And they were there, they would then play the national anthem, and we would sing it and bow, and then Yamashita would come along and we'd bow low to him and so on. I mean, you know, that sort of a thing. Schools, of course, were started, and that was another avenue for propaganda. And we will touch on the Japanese medical school later on. And of course, the newspapers are full of it, you know, full of the glories of Nippon, full of the successes of Nippon in the war, and full of the bad aspects of British colonialism, American colonialism, and so on. These are the things that they were feeding us with. And they were making pretty sure that the population were not getting information from outside, which many people were doing anyway, through radios. And if they were caught, they were thrown into the YMCA and not treated well at all there, tortured. There were informers among the population, and one would have to be very careful what one said, because one never knew whether what you said would be carried back to the authorities. We would tell tales. And so we used to be very careful, except of course with those who we knew, our relatives and so on. And even so, you know, we were very guarded.
Did you know of people who were asked by the Kempeitai to go to YMCA?
Oh, yes. My two brothers. First of all, my brother Gino, who later was Sir George, was taken in. For what reason, I really don't know, but I do believe it's because they alleged that he was listening into the radio and spreading rumors. But he was in for 2 weeks. And the day he was released, my eldest brother, Dr. R.C. Olas, Derek we called him, was taken in. And Derek was kept interned, imprisoned, for the entire duration. From the YMCA, he was thrown into Outram Road prison. My brother-in-law, R.F. Smith, he was also taken in by the Kempeitai. He was a Red Star chap. He was taken there, and he was ill-treated. Other specific cases, I can't quite remember, but these relatives of mine were taken in.
Did you know what kind of treatment they were given at YMCA and Outram Prison?
You know, funnily, they wouldn't want to talk about it. But from hearsay, it's this water treatment by which they pump your body, put a tube down and pump you full of water, and then they press it and gush it out again, which is not nice. And of course things like fingernails, poking nails or pins into fingernails, or pulling out fingernails, things like that, burning the bodies with cigarettes and so on.
When your brother was in YMCA for 2 weeks, Could you have visit him?
No. No way. And in fact, we were too scared to even ask, in case we were thrown in ourselves.
What about the other brothers? The other brother, R.C.?
Oh, yes. No, we couldn't. We lost contact with him altogether. He, his wife, and his family, I think, might have been able to contact him, but I didn't. Certainly, I wasn't able to.
What was the reason for your elder brother for being taken away?
I believe for listening into the radio,
both of them.
And yes, and for propagating the information they got from the radios. We could get, you know, if you could get BBC quite clearly, because that was beamed to Southeast Asia for propaganda reasons.
When your brother was released, did the Japanese sort of get him into trouble again?
My brother
Sir
Gino?
George?
No. No. He, I know that he used to, he started off his law practice again. I don't know to what extent he was able to do, to practice law, but he and his partner, Mr. Eric Chua, they were doing law. He used to cycle to his office in Market Street. My brother Derek, R.C., Dr. R.C., he was a medical doctor, and of course he was in all the time. And his wife and family, and his wife had quite a time to survive. We were not, my brothers and myself were not living too far apart. In fact, I had an uncle and aunt who were staying in Thompson Road, where the Gold Hill Plaza is. And there, in that house of theirs, my brother Sir George and his wife stayed, and my mother and father stayed. And my brother, Dr. R.C. Olas, was taken away, was staying in the municipal quarters near Kampong Java Road. So we're not too far away, and we used to sort of visit each other. Occasionally we'd play mahjong together, and we had some kind of relationship, but it was shattering when one was taken, then the other was taken, and the third was taken. Dr. R.F. Smith, you know, he's Roy Smith, my brother-in-law, taken, then Gino taken, Derek taken, and we'll come to that. And this is why I went to Bahau, because I was told by this officer called Naito. And I remember him so clearly telling me, "Jock, please get the hell out of Singapore, because you're next."
When were your brothers and brother-in-law taken away?
Now, I think that this was in 19... I think my brother-in-law must have been taken towards the end of 1942, and sometime in 1943, Gino was taken, and then my brother Derek was taken, and I went to, made arrangements to go to Bahau about December 1943.
What happened to your brother Derek subsequently?
He was eventually released from Outram Road Hospital when the British came back. In a very bad state of health. He had beriberi. Now, that was another disease that was rampant in Singapore, due to malnutrition, beriberi. And was treated in hospital, and he recovered, went back to his job in the municipality as a municipal doctor. But unfortunately, when he reached the age of 45, a few years after the reoccupation, he had a heart attack and died. All, I'm sure, due to the effects of his internment.
Talking about your family, how was relationship like during this time?
well, we so as much as we could as possible, but it could have been closer. We were closer to my wife's family because although he had remarried, his first wife, my mother-in-law, was staying with us in our side of a semi-detached house. And we got along pretty well. I was very fond of my father-in-law, although in the first few days of the occupation, Japanese occupation, you know, nerves were shaken, and we were sometimes short with each other. I remember having a few words with my father-in-law, which I always regret. Because he was a wonderful man, very generous. I got on very well with him.
Was there any kind of discussion about Japanese policies among all of you? What was happening in Singapore and all that?
All the time, you know, we were hoping for an end to this Japanese occupation, all the time, hoping against hope. But as the days wore on, we realized that it would be an awful long wait before the British came back, if they ever did. And those of us who were sensible to it realized that in order to survive, we'd have to go along. We'd have to do what they told us to do. We would, you know, they say, okay, you've got to change your clocks to Nippon time. We all did that. And you have to go and report to such and such a place to hear a proclamation. We'd do that. You know, we'd do that. Some would, of course, not do it. But I think they were stupid. They were not been asking for trouble. So you go along with them. Go along with them.
But within the family, did you sort of criticize or talk about such measures taken by the Japanese?
Oh, we used to, of course, be quite... we used to feel sorry for ourselves. I mean, you know, we would consider ourselves lucky to be able to live the way we're able to live, and that we'd have to go about life the best way we could. We did, of course, hope, I mean, among ourselves, gosh, we wish we could hear a B-29 or something fly over, you know, some hope that there's some move that there'd be reoccupation. This is just this hope. I mean, what else? What could we say? What could we talk? You know, we couldn't say anything. We would grumble about the fact that food is difficult to get, expensive, and it was during this period. See, I got married, my wife and I, 2 weeks before Singapore fell, roughly. And sometime about 6 months, 7 months later, my wife got very ill because she got pregnant and she had miscarriage, and she was bleeding badly. And fortunately, in Norfolk Road, not far from us, was staying a good friend of ours, Dr. Shears, the late President Benjamin Shears. And he looked after my wife. And then next year or so, she got pregnant again. Again, she nearly got a miscarriage. But this time, Benjamin Shears was able to save the baby. And before, just before we left, a few months before we left, 6 months before we left for Bahau, our first son was born, Michael. He's a doctor now and lives in Perth.
Did you have to register your son with
Yes.
Do you remember how you go about doing that?
I even got his birth certificate, I think. I got a copy of his original birth certificate. Maybe you'd like to see it. I've got it. It was registered, he was born at Kanankrabha Hospital, and I've got the original. I'll get it for you if I'll, I won't forget.
So during that time, were you supporting your own family, or do you have to support your in-laws as well as your own family?
No, no. My father-in-law, in fact, was the main breadwinner. He was a doctor, and I tried to do the best I could. We'll talk about this, the medical school that I, so-called medical school that I went to, which I eventually gave up. And I took on a job as a telephone operator, hopefully to earn some money, but I was getting $45 a month. Then I resorted to trying to manufacture tooth powder. Do you want me to talk about this tooth powder? It might be interesting, because this is, of course, a commodity which is much in need of. And there were all kinds of tooth powders in the market. I thought, well, maybe I'd try to break in on this. And I worked out some kind of a formula. Turned out a very pleasantly tasting tooth powder, which is the most important thing, the taste and the freshness that it gave. And I called it Kulene, K-U-L-E-N-E, Cool and Clean. And I tried to market it. I had them in, like the little containers were little cylinders, metal cylinders, and wrapped around it was the label, quite an attractive label designed by Dr. Van Kallenberg's wife. She's an artist, and we call it Colleen. It was a turquoise in color, and based it around, and first of all, I used to make it with a pestle and mortar, and then later on, my brother Derek had a friend who was an engineer. He built me a mixer, electric mixer, no, manual mixer, but something easier than a pestle and mortar. So I was turning out this tooth powder, and I had employed an armor to pack it, and to label it, and to put all these tubes into packages of 12 for the market. Next thing is to introduce it. Of course, being new, none of these grocers or any of these firms would want to buy them off me, so I put quantities of this tooth powder on consignment in these shops. They sell them, and I'd go back after a month and collect the money and give them a new supply. I advertised in the Shonan Shimbun. And, of course, I got some of my friends to go around and say what a wonderful tooth powder this was. But there's one place which refused to stock it, the most important department store in town. That's called, that was Aurora's department store, which was in High Street, the junction of High Street and Northbridge Road. They wouldn't have anything to do with it because there were enough of tooth powders in the market, some from Japan, some already made locally. So I simply got my friends to go there and say, look, I'd like some tooth powder, please. And they say, yes, what would you like? They said, Kulene. He said, what, tooth powder, Kulene? He said, well, and then they utter a sort of expressions of surprise that they would not be stocking Kulene. So very soon, the next time I did my rounds, I went in, would you like to have some Kulene on consignment? Yes. So and it sold very well. Became the most popular tooth powder in Singapore. You know, so popular that I could have easily blackmailed it and made money. The prices are fixed, you see, by the Japanese. Prices are fixed. But I could have very well have made it unobtainable or difficult to obtain, released a little bit, and blackmailed the rest, and black marketed the rest of it. But I was scared. Very scared. I was stupid, I suppose.
Did you have to report to the Japanese about your, the powder, the tooth powder?
Yeah, the Tokubetsu C.
Which department?
Health department, or is it medical? Yeah, I think health department.
So you have to
eventually, eventually, when I was on, when I was going to Bahau. It was before I went to Bahau. Before I was going to Bahau, because I had very little time. A Japanese firm, one of the big department firms of Japan, Matsuzakaya, they approached me to ask me to sell the rights, my former letter to them. You know, they'd give me so much, but of course we had no bargaining power. They more or less directed me to do it. So I had no alternative but to say yes, tried a little bit of bargaining with them, you know. They took it over nevertheless, but I didn't give them the right formula. I gave them a little different. So what the colleen that they produced wasn't nearly as nice as the one that I did.
So when they took over, you had to stop doing
it? Yes, of course. But by that time, though, I was ready to go to Bahau.
Where did you get all your materials to?
I used to buy them from the chemists. I could get the calcium carbonate, which is the base, the menthol, and the sweetener. Difficult. Get in the black market. And I was able to produce it.
Do you remember how much did you sell them?
I can't remember the price now. And after that, because people are so used to toothpaste, and toothpaste is not available, I produced toothpaste. But not in tubes, you know. Couldn't get tubes. I made them like syringes. I used the same cylindrical container, but I used a plunger made out of balsa wood, and a little hole on top through which the cream came out when you pressed the plunger below. Of course, you had to be careful how to use it because you'd splatter your whole face with it if you didn't do it carefully. But that was popular. But again, shelf life was very limited, so I'd have to issue very few at a time, and so that it could be used up before it hardened to a hard rock.
That was after...
After that, I introduced the powder, and I tried to get the toothpaste in the market.
Did it have a name?
Colleen toothpaste, yeah. Yeah, that was very good. That was very sold very well. But unfortunately, it didn't have long shelf life. Because the thing that made it creamy was called gum tragacanth. And gum tragacanth kept over a period of time would harden. So
it started off as a powder and then became a toothpaste?
I produced both, powder and paste. Paste was, of course, much more expensive.
Just now you were talking about Japanese propaganda. Did they ask the local people to celebrate their festivals, any of their important occasions?
Yes, by assembling at the Esplanade, singing the national anthem, bowing to the flags. Yes, every now and again. But they allowed us to celebrate our Christmas, our own religious festivals. They allowed us to go to church. And there was they didn't hinder us whatsoever in that respect.
Do you know anything about the auxiliary police system during that time?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I know that it existed, but I didn't know the strata, how they function. I really don't.
What about things like compulsory labor for the local people?
Yes. Well, they call it voluntary labor. And you were supposed to report with charcoals and made to do some work for them.